guests will be Tallis Kohlberg and Kevin Brew. I want to thank Tallis and Kevin for joining me today as we talked about The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris by David McCullough. Thank you both.
Thank you. Well,
thanks for having me.
I think history can be really boring if you are, depending on how it's presented. I think it's really about storytelling, and some people tell stories well and some people don't. And I think having taught history for a long time at the college, that some people just aren't interested. There are other things that are more appealing to them, and it's that initial introduction that makes a huge difference as to whether someone takes an interest or not. And if the, you know, there's a tendency of some people to turn history into something of a tedious topic. And so the value of a good writer like McCullough is that he has the ability to make things seem interesting to lay people who don't necessarily have a focus on history in their life, but will like the stories he takes and make them into a good story. And, you know, some people are frustrated at history because there's always a different way to tell the same story, and they get just like, that's not the same thing, or they feel that's the wrong version. But that actually adds flavor to it if you really get into it, because there are all sorts of perspectives on just about everything. And if you get past the idea that the first perspective is the only one, I can add to the picture.
So in this one, he's talking about Americans who go to Paris and kind of the impact on Paris as well as the impact on those Americans. But he starts talking about, his quote is, "Not all pioneers went west." And so I think that this might be a piece of history that a lot of, so let's say, people who study history or students in schools may not be exposed to. So let's just start talking about, you know, why did Americans travel to Europe and Paris in particular at this period of time, which he starts out, I think it's about 1830.
Well, I think there was a natural affinity in the United States in its early years to go to Paris over any other of the options that might have been available in Europe, just because they were the main ally for us in the Revolution, which many people were still alive in 1830 that had been alive when the Revolution was occurring, and were very much aware that the French were the instrumental factor in bringing the Revolution to a successful conclusion when it happened. It might have taken quite a bit longer without French intervention on our behalf. Other thing I think to keep mindful of here is that, you know, as now, very few Americans actually went to Europe, and those who could were from what you'd have to call the social elite, people who had the means to take months, which would have taken in those days to just take the time to go to Europe and survive without working. And so these were the well-to-do and their children that were making this journey, and this was going to what was then like a shining city on a hill compared to anything in the United States. Mm-hmm. That was the center of Western civilization other than London. From an American point of view, a natural place to go.
Yeah, I just tune in on that. You know, the American Revolution, the War of 1812-14, I mean, it had only been less than 20 years since the British had burned down Washington. So that, you know, another reason why, you know, perhaps Paris would have been favored over London, which would have been the other obvious choice. And I think the whole idea of, you know, the people that were heading west were, you know, looking for land, looking for new opportunities, and the folks that were heading east to back to Europe, and again, as Tallis pointed out, you know, for the most part would be more of the social elite, but they were looking for that, those seeds of culture and the more permanent parts of, you know, Western culture, I guess.
So he talks about some of the differences then that are observed between what's happening in Paris by these American visitors. And a couple of things that struck me were, of course, like you said, I mean, this was the old world, and so the arts and the appreciation that they had for going into the Louvre and seeing these magnificent works of arts that had been there for, you know, hundreds of years. He talks about the clothing differences. So you really start to get a sense of that this is civilization versus, you know, what America might have looked like, kind of homespun and you know, more grainy and maybe, you know, yeah, not as cultured as what they were seeing.
It's still, to a large extent, that's still true. I mean, America's older than it was at the time of Cullis writing, but you know, especially living in a place like Alaska. I mean, where if a building's 100 years old here, that's ancient. There's nothing uncommon about it in Europe. And I think that's a huge thing. Is it's just the ancient nature of it, the more permanent nature of it than we have here.
It evoked a sense of nostalgia for me because I can actually relate directly to this concept. I left Palmer for Europe for the first time in my life when I was 20 years old to go to law school in London. And I remember that first time I took the ferry across the Straits of Dover to Calais. It was very much like I was described in the book. You know, the sun's breaking through the clouds, and you see this place that obviously has ancient buildings compared to anything we have in Palmer, Alaska. And you feel like you're moving into a movie of sorts. The first day in London was like being in the Star Wars bar. It was, people walking down the streets with every outfit you can imagine. You know, you don't see people with fezes, turbans, and Sikh outfits, and the Royal Guards on horses coming down the street in Palmer, Alaska. So it just instantly jolts all your senses into high action when you're accustomed to living in the old world here, new world here, and you go over to the old world even well over a century after the period this book focuses on. It had to be equally engaging for people who had taken a month to get there in the first place and had never seen anything like this. So,
you're pointing out again the really valid reason to read history, because there is that connectedness that you were getting at, I think, Kevin, that, you know, this isn't just things that happened in the past, that we can relate it to our own lives and our own experiences.
Well, and if you are interested in history before you go on a journey like that, which I would imagine most of these people were, having probably gotten as good an education as you were going to get in the United States at that time period, you would have been steeped in the classics at that time period. So you would have known something about the cathedrals and the battles and the places that you were visiting. And so there would have been a familiarity to the names, and then suddenly you were able to look at the place and connect it all. And that's, I remember, you know, I knew about Canterbury Cathedral, but to see it in person where Thomas à Becket was killed was one of those moments where, it now all fits together. Or standing in front of Notre Dame Cathedral the first time, and there's a statue of Charlemagne in front, and you realize when you're looking at it for the first time that this figure in French history looked like a Viking, and he's portrayed as like a Viking right then and there. And so, you know, you make these connections that you would have only maybe had a hint of in a book, and that certainly would have been helpful preparatory material, but suddenly you get more interested in it and want to read more.
And it sounds like you do that, and maybe you do that too, Kevin. But I know when I'm traveling someplace, I try to read some of the history before I go to the place, and then I feel like I know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you're standing in Agincourt, it's just the place, unless you know the history or what occurred there.
One quote from the book, Thomas Appleton, he's one of the wealthy travelers. I think that was kind of a whole category, people that were like the tourist or the higher socioeconomic group that you were mentioning, Thomas. And he says, good Americans, when they die, go to Paris. and I put that on here to talk about, and I thought, what did he mean? Why would he say that?
I don't know. It was certainly a witty comment, and I suppose, you know, perhaps for him, you know, Paris... He was a guy that he would always go back to the States, but then he'd go back to Paris. So I think, you know, just had an attraction. You know, Paris is heaven.
He didn't die.
I would say that's the conclusion I drew, is that this is as close to heaven as he was going to get. And I think the thing about Appleton is, again, you have this interconnectedness of a lot of these folks that you wouldn't necessarily have known knew each other from just reading them as classic books by themselves. But he was, in fact, the brother-in-law-to-be of Henry W. Longfellow, and his sister, who married Longfellow, had a tragic death when she burned to death in front of Longfellow when her nightgown caught on fire. And until that happened, you know, they were, you know, all very close, and they had this Paris connection in the background. And so there's another quote somewhere buried in the book, and I should have marked the page, where the one fellow went back many years later, it might have been Holmes, I'm not sure, and met a younger person, and he came up with something like, this is, you're young, live it to the most, because that's I think what, you know, I would have that sense that there was no better time in their lives when they had no responsibilities, had the ability to visit with each other and this place in that setting. And that's probably what's missing in the book for me. That we were talking before the show started. There's no focus in my mind on an event. And it's a collection of stories that share a common experience that it's sometimes hard to get, well, so what? So what that Longfellow knew Appleton or that Morse knew Cooper, it's the idea that the bonds and the friendships that came from this carried forward in all their lives in many, many ways for years to come. And that's why I think traveling abroad and as American with a group gives you a bond that's one of the more enduring types of friendship that can transit time, because friendships tend to come and go, but these are some of the more lasting ones, I think, that come from something like this.
So you mentioned the one friendship that McCullough talks about, James Fenimore Cooper and Samuel Morse. And did they know each other in the United States?
They did. They knew each other. They'd met, and they had, I'm trying to remember now. Maybe Talis remembers it. I don't know if they had worked on something, project together. But anyway, they did know each other. But the real bond happened in Paris, I think, for a lot of these people. That wouldn't have happened if they'd all just kind of stayed in the United States. You know, they may have met each other or whatnot, but that commonality of being an American in a foreign place does draw you together, you know, a lot tighter than it might have been if they were just had stayed at home.
And I would add to that, when I was in London, there were 13, it was the first year Pepperdine had a law school class in London. There were only 13 of us, but we became very close. And you know, oddly enough, and this sounds awful, where did we meet most often in London, England, was the Texas Lone Star Saloon, where we would have hamburgers and pop and watch videos running over and over again, Western clips, you know, so where we were immersing ourselves totally in European culture. Not entirely. You tend to hang together, but at the same time, we were having European experiences, and we had them together, and, you know, it's something about a great moment isn't much unless you have someone to share it with, and that's who you were sharing the moments with, is those people that were with you. And
well, one of the things that we hear a lot about is who could speak French and who could not. And so I think that was some of the comfortableness then, or the security in seeking people who spoke your language. So if there was Americans who did not speak French, that they could find other Americans and, you know, have some commonality of experience then, because they couldn't speak the language.
And that kind of, there's really two tiers of types of Americans that he talks about in this book. One is the artistic class, the writers, the sculptors, and then there's the prior class, the ones who really opened the door, which was the diplomats, the Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, John Quincy Adams, and you know, I kind of think that one of the reasons it's likely that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson reconciled in their later years and got together is they had shared that common experience in Paris when they did get along before they had their breaking apart. And that, you know, it was Thomas Jefferson who took John Quincy Adams, the boy, all around Europe with him under his wing. And, you know, those three gentlemen all learned French and had to learn it that way. But that was you know, I can imagine there were people that didn't learn it as well as some, but there certainly is no better way to learn a language than to be immersed in the place. And that would, again, make that special bond.
I think he does mention, you know, like in the case of Cooper and Morse, that, you know, Cooper picked up French pretty quickly and was fluent in it, and Morse just always had problems, you know, with it. You know, I think a big difference for people at that time, because it did take so long to get there, and you did tend to, once you got there, you stayed there longer, so there was certainly more of a need to at least pick up the rudiments of the language than for us. I mean, if we go to Paris for 5 or 6 days or even a week or two, we're not necessarily going to learn more than just a few phrases, so, but it was a lot
Americans,
more important, yeah.
We expect them to speak. English to us.
But I think
well, English has become, you know, that was another difference, though. In that time, I mean, French was a lot more of an international language maybe than it is now. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, in this world, if you speak one language, English is the language. And if it's going to be a second language, probably Spanish. You know, French is still important and it's still a language of culture, but it's not, I don't think it has the importance that it did 150 or 60 years ago.
Well, I think languages for the people who were going from America at that time would have been a basic core part of their educational curriculum. There would have been none of these folks that had any basic education that would have had to have mandatory Latin for several years. And so that they would have been rooted in the Romance languages in a way that most Americans would have no idea anymore if they had a college education. You can look through the transcripts of almost any American college in the year 1890 and see that people are taking several languages. And so while most Americans, other than recent immigrants, weren't going to be speaking multiple languages, you would find that although it was a much smaller fraction of the population that was getting college education, if you went to college in the 1800s, you were likely to have had to pass threshold language qualifying exams to get into the few universities that we had. One of the things that John Adams did was tutor John Quincy Adams rigorously in Greek and languages just to get into entrance exams into Harvard. You weren't going to get into a college without passing a preliminary language test, which is no longer a part of our system at all.
I want to remind listeners that this is 89.5, and you're listening to Radio Book Club. We're talking about The Greater Journey by David McCullough. And we were just mentioning Cooper and Morse. And I think before the show started, Kevin and I were both saying that we didn't know Morse was an artist. You know, you think of Samuel Morse, he invented Morse code and, you know.
The telegraph,
yeah. And so that's what we learned about him. And he goes into great detail about the painting, the gallery at the Louvre, and all the work that went into that. And it's a stunning work. I love the inclusion of the pictures in here so that we could really get a better, you know, visual, obviously, of what he was telling us. But the picture is of this gallery in the Louvre that has all these, well, he's personally selected which paintings he wanted to copy and put in there. But so each one of those copies was a work of itself. And so it was a stunning, stunning painting. And I just wanted to point out that he said that it sold for $1,300 and he was hoping to get $2,500. And then in 1982, the painting sold for $3,250,000.
He just waited.
You know, you almost hope that these artists somehow know, if there's an afterlife, that they know that they're value increased.
Well, and I'm trying to remember the commission that he didn't get. Maybe Talis remembers.
The only two numbers that stick in my head are that Cooper got $20,000 for The Last of the Mohicans while he was apparently over there, which would have been a fortune in that time period. Mm-hmm. And that Augustus St. Gaudens got for the statue of Sherman, a significant a commission for that, and it was enough to get him going big time. But
well, if Morris had gotten more money, maybe he wouldn't have bothered with the telegraph. So
that's right, because then when he did
kind
not
of unfortunate.
Get, yeah, yeah. When he did not get that commission, is when he said, "I'm done with painting," and
right.
Went on to work on his invention. So it was a pivotal moment. Mm-hmm. Another group that we learn about are the medicals, and for individuals in the United States who wanted training in the field of medicine, Paris was the place to go. They had established hospitals since the early 1600s. They had numerous hospitals, and they had many advantages to medical students that the United States did not have. So I don't know, what did you guys kind of observe or see about that?
Well, there was just what you pointed out. I guess the other thing that struck me was, you know, like during the was the advantage that we have with modern medicine. Paris may have been, France may have been somewhat more advanced in some of their technology, medical technologies, than the United States or other countries, but not that much more advanced. And I was struck, when the cholera epidemic hit, and just the devastation that caused. And, talking about, why do you study history? Sometimes I'll hear people talk about the dangers of vaccines or whatever, and you think, this is a lot better world with it than people fleeing the city in fear, just fear and ignorance of what, there may be some idea what caused it, but, really no idea how to stop it. Mm-hmm. And so that I probably doesn't really answer your question, but that did strike me, as far as the medical end of it. Yeah, appreciation of that.
Yeah, I had a similar reaction when we get into the section about the grave robbing and the throwing the cadaver leftovers to the dogs after using them at the medical school. This with all of that and the gruesome nature of it, that still was the place to go in the world. And apparently about 700 future American physicians got their basic training there because it was better than anyone else. Mm-hmm. And so
they talked about the number of cases they'd be exposed to, too, that, if they had practiced in the United States, that they may have seen one or two, but here, because of the population and having the hospitals, they really were given an opportunity to deal with a number of pregnancies or dealing with a number of cholera patients so that they really got a lot more experience. But, yes, the cadavers was another thing in the United States. It wasn't was it against the law? So, they could not have cadavers over in France. People in the hospital who knew they were dying would say, yes, you can have my body when I'm dead. And so there was seemed to be a more easy acceptance of that. The other thing that he says, and you don't know if it's maybe McCullough kind of editorializing or not, but that the surgeons sometimes, if you have a hammer and you see a nail, then
right.
Everything looks like a nail if you have a hammer. So they wanted to practice their craft, and so they would do surgery just because they wanted to cut.
Well, and then again, even things like surgery. This is another book I was just covering a period with about Samuel Pepys, but the operation he had to have his kidney stones removed. I mean, we wouldn't even dream of going through something like that. So again, I won't even describe it. It was pretty awful. But just the improved medical technology. I mean, that just strikes. That always strikes me when I'm reading a history. 200, 300, 400 years ago. Pretty important.
No anesthesia.
No anesthesia, and you just have to know how painful kidney stones would be that he would go through this,
mm-hmm.
With probably about a 50-50 chance that it was going to kill him.
Well, and that's what is pointed out in the book, is that many of these people, they have surgery and then they would die. I think mm-hmm. the greater proportion did pass away from the surgery. So, another group that we're introduced to is the American Curiosities. So this was kind of a fun section, I thought. So P.T. Barnum comes over with Tom Thumb. Tom Thumb was a huge hit with the royals and with the court.
There's a spin-off of this that I think is fascinating that still exists in Paris today at the American Disneyland in Paris. And it's the Buffalo Bill had the traveling show that he had taken to Europe several times. It was a huge sensation in Paris. And you can buy a separate ticket if you go to the Paris Disneyland to a sideshow, which is a huge arena where they divide the audience into Americans and French people, and they say, now we'll eat like Americans. We won't use utensils, and we'll bang our pots when we want something. So, there's the constant jibes at us, and mixed in with it, half the audience or more is American. And the arena is filled with ice fog, and then out come real buffaloes, cowboys, and Indian stagecoaches, and it's meant to be a reenactment of the Buffalo Bill Wild West show that so fascinated the Parisians in the late 1800s and the rest of Europe.
Well, and I think this is really a point, too, where, that the Americans had been going to Paris to see the old world and immerse themselves in everything that it had to offer, but now we're bringing with us what America has to offer in terms of what's unique to America.
And to this day, we sort of still stand out. Many times in London, I remember walking into a shop and someone would say, you're an American, having said nothing, and it was because I was wearing tennis shoes mm-hmm. instead of what I was supposed to be wearing or the way I just dressed. And mm-hmm. so, we were humorous, sad way, kind of an inspiration. A lot of people don't realize that when Bram Stoker wrote Dracula, he cast as the humorous hero Buffalo Bill was the figure he used to create the American character that kills Dracula, and most people don't remember Dracula was killed by a Bowie knife in the real original story, and that's a carryover of the American oddity, unique characters that they perceived us in Europe as these rustic rubes. So we have our little footnotes in history all over the place.
And just exposure to really, I mean, something that the Europeans didn't have. So when George Catlin came with his 500 paintings of Indians, which I had mentioned, I had just come back from Arizona and I'd gone to the Heard Museum, which I had never done before. And so there was an original Catlin painting in there that they were exhibiting. And, you know, all the Indian artifacts and things that the Europeans, I'm sure, just conjured up all kinds of images and stories. And then,
well, there's the famous painting, it wasn't mentioned in this book, where a French artist supposedly had heard of the description of Custer's Last Stand and the phrase of all of the cotton-picking Indians, where they all come from. And so he portrayed it as happening in a cotton field.
I didn't know that, but that's a good one. Well, I think, you know, for Europeans, I mean, they had lost, the culture was there, but they had obviously lost the wildness. And, you know, that would be huge, these shows coming, whether Buffalo Bill or, you know, in the case of the book, Catlin, that would be absolutely fascinating to them. It would be fascinating to Europeans that were going, like guys like the Tocqueville and what, you know, that we're going to the United States to.
Mm-hmm. And it would explain the appeal of The Last of the Mohicans.
Absolutely. And, yeah, absolutely. It was this thought that came to mind. I was camping up at Paxton a number of years ago, and there was a German tourist, German policeman, as he described himself. But his hands, I always remember him putting his hands up, and he just starts, it's so big. You know, it's so wild, it's so big, that's still impressive to Europeans to this day.
Yeah, the vastness. And just the unusualness, because these are things that they obviously did not have in Europe. So when, you know, real life Indians come and do their dances and wear their clothing and speak their language and
right. It's the wildness.
And it's the compactness there. You can drive basically from London, England, to Edinburgh, Scotland in the same time, well, quicker there, but 300 miles as it would be from here to Fairbanks. And mm-hmm. So, you know, these are tens of millions of people living in tiny, tiny sections of land.
Yeah, day of train travel, you can cross several countries. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different... And even inside those countries, it'll be, I can, you know, as soon as you open your mouth, I know what part of the country you came from, probably know what your religion is and, you know, what your education background is. You know, it's kind of a different thing than it is here.
It's very easy to cross France in one day by train or by car.
But many of these Americans were coming from New England. So, I mean, they kind of have that sense, too. I mean... Yeah, I mean, those are very small states.
Most of them are coming from New England. Some are coming from the Midwest.
But the big difference would have been there would have been far, far fewer people in New England than in Europe in the same way.
So I'm going to pause to take a station identification break.
You are listening to KVRF FM, Radio Free Palmer. We are an all-volunteer station. New volunteers are welcome. Email us at manager@radiofreepalmer.org or call 745-8951. Big Cabbage Radio welcomes your help.
Okay, we're back talking about David McCullough's book, The Greater Journey. And, you know, we were talking that maybe Paris is the main character of this book, or it certainly is the theme of the book. And I think the weakest part for me personally is because I just didn't know the history of France and their politics was going through kind of the different political things that were happening. And then how does that contribute to the story he's telling?
I think it's a flaw in the book because he presumes that a reader is going to know quite a bit, and I think that is a complicated period in French history. I would describe it as a pendulum period. You can start off the book, if you would, with a monarchy period where you know you have Jefferson and Adams experiencing life under an absolute monarch. Then it goes into a revolution where they just virtually destroy everything to the point of having to shut down their own revolution with a return to the monarchy. And then this book kind of picks up after the monarchy's been restored, but then it goes through basically their second republic, and then you get into a monarchy again, and then you've got the overlay of this war with Germany, and then ending in the commune, the absolute disintegration of social order and civilization in Paris to the point of repeating in many ways what had happened during the revolution, people proposing literally to destroy the Notre Dame Cathedral and destroy everything in the Louvre. It's like a revisitation of ISIS in the center of what you think of as civilization. And I think it's a reminder that here you have this country that we idealized as Americans as the center of everything that can be, that had gone in a period of literally 70 years, two periods of literally trying to dismantle everything we revered to the point of trying to erase it from all time and memory. So it is complicated because it is like a pendulum. It goes from and with each swing of that pendulum, you have people, because they're killing each other, the people have survivors, friends, relatives who want to get even. And it's going from generation to generation. And so the bloodshed is incredible. I mean, this is Paris where tens of thousands of people are killing each other and in many ways trying to settle scores from the decades before. And you have this group of Americans kind of, this is interesting. Uh-oh, this is scary. And how do we get out of here?
Well, I was also reminded that you mentioned the ISIS, but you know, I was also reminded when they were talking about the commune or reading about the commune there that that's where the Khmer Rouge leadership learned their politics was in Paris. So,
and McCullough makes a weird statement. He says it had nothing to do with communism, but in fact the phrase is Marx himself looked as the commune uprising as the hope for future communist uprisings, and they tried to be against all social convention, all upper middle class, all religion. It was pretty close to being on mark for what a communist revolution traditionally looked like.
Yeah, so, I absolutely would have to agree with that. I think the other thing that would strike an American, you know, given that we'd had a revolution, given that we had a civil war, was just the extreme. The French always seemed to, we'd have these extreme revolutions, and then they would end up in, you know, an emperor or some kind of dictatorship. You know, we would go just these wild swings. And I think for an American that wasn't that far removed from the revolution, or, you know, our civil war was certainly bloody enough, but there wasn't civilians so much attacking each other. I think after the end of our civil war, I think it was exactly one Southerner hung, you know, that was actually executed over what had happened. Which was just a totally different situation in anywhere, where probably in Europe, where, you know, whoever won, I mean, it was just, the retribution was just absolutely overwhelming and gratuitous, you know, just violence.
Yeah, McCullough talks a little bit about the Marquis de Lafayette, who was a hero in our country and visited many years after the American Revolution, was treated like a national hero here. He describes the funeral in this book where 200,000 Parisians show up. So he obviously had a following and a reverence there. But it in the context of this great swings of what their attitude about their own views was, the same man had been condemned to death during the French Revolution and was under house arrest to be executed, and probably only survived because of American efforts to save him diplomatically in that time period. So, again, you have the French almost not being able to decide what they themselves were all about. Curious about us, fascinated about us, but a little bit pixelated about what their own identity was.
Yeah, so, well, they had the revolution in 1848, and then Louis Napoleon winds up being elected president. And then, you know, a few years later, basically a coup, internal coup, and it's you know, they go to a plebiscite to validate the coup, and you know, it's overwhelming support. You know, you just it's just hard to fathom.
To say what did the people want?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And if you're an American there, as McCullough is describing during these upheavals, it would have been amazing, as long as you weren't afraid that you'd be yourself consumed. And to a certain extent, if you're identified as a foreigner, you're somewhat untouched in most of these situations. But I remember living in London during the Falklands War and watching a society surge into nationalism almost spontaneously, and watching punk rockers talk about how they were going to enlist in the Royal Marines the day after Argentina invaded the Falkland Islands. And so, you know, it's not your country, so you're a little bit arm's length about it, but you are watching how basic core emotions erupt in a society, and it's a huge educational experience that you don't have a dog in the fight, so you're not really particularly concerned about the outcome, but you're watching how other people react. And so I think that later gives you a perspective when you see things in your own country that you wonder, you know, you back up and look at it differently. So again, these were huge educational experiences for Americans on many levels, not just formal instruction, but to be in a different society, and I think that's what McCullough is trying to get across here, it creates insights and bonds with people that are with you at the time.
And do you think that this contributes to one of the things that it's pointed out in the book over and over again, is many of these people, no matter how long they stayed, and Healy stayed in Paris for 57 years, that they always identified as Americans?
Yeah, I think it's hard not to. I mean, I had... again, an experience set that I would not have anticipated. I've always been fairly partisan, even as a young person, and I found myself defending President Carter, who I'd never voted for, because I was just kind of almost offended by the way some people would talk about Americans. And it usually start like this. I like you personally, but I hate your country. And then go on a rant as if that was license for you not to defend yourself. And so you would almost viscerally want to defend whatever they were attacking, even though you hadn't really supported it necessarily when you were at home. So you do tend to, I think, naturally, more often than not, associate with your countrymen in a setting where you probably wouldn't associate with them at all at home.
So, no, I think that's – I've had exactly the same experience where I found myself defending something that we're at home. If it's the three of us speaking about it, I would cover it a lot differently. Mm-hmm. But just because it's a foreigner, you know, you absolutely automatically, you know, just go to defending the – I don't know. Nationalism is still a very strong impulse in this world. And I think, yeah, the Americans, it's just an interesting thing to me, Americans, and it's still, I mean, Americans can live overseas for many, many, many years, and they're still identifying as an American. We visited with a fellow in London that's friends of a friend. He's lived in London. He's Bob Mai. He's in his early 60s. He's lived in London since his 20s. He still speaks as an American. He has no British accent. He still identifies as an American, and it's just kind of and I asked him about that, and he, you know, he just said it just, he had never really thought about it or consciously made any kind of decision like that, but that was, he had just never considered any alternative other than that's what he was.
Along with that, some of the Americans during these tumultuous periods, though, he pointed out that some of them were ready to join up. And I think that, you know, even if they were still identifying as Americans, they couldn't help but identify also with that, the fight for freedom or, you know, whatever the cause was. And they identified with that as, you know, coming from a Republican country. So
right. Well, I think a lot of these things, the initial sympathy is going to be with the revolutionaries against because of our history. Mm-hmm. You know, talk about Washburn, the American ambassador, who we can be very proud of how his behavior during those times. I mean, one of the few ambassadors that stuck. He does have an initial sympathy until he sees, you know, just this overwhelming, violent, I only could call it gratuitous violence. The destruction, you know, going can't remember what it was, the Napoleon Tower that they...
The statue they knocked down.
Yeah, they knocked down, and then they were threatening the Louvre, threatening Notre Dame.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, for him, this would be beyond the pale. Mm-hmm. I mean, now we've gone from a revolution, a Republican type of revolution, to chaos, I guess, you know.
Because Washburn keeps an excellent diary, a daily diary throughout the siege and what's happening during the commune. But he maintains his political role, but then he also does a lot of humanitarian work. Is that a call for us?
Should be able to find out. Can you?
Well, while you're checking that, we will. So. He's providing shelter for women and children who are somewhat refugees, for Germans that were had been ordered out of the city and had not,
couldn't get out of the
city.
Yep. Siege. And he did, you know, he worked with the Germans as much as he could to get as many people out as he possibly could. No, he did, you know, he was kind of everywhere every day. And again, he was... You know, at least according to the book, I didn't know that much about this guy before I'd heard the name. But, you know, he was kind of considered a political hack, you know, kind of a Grant Republican guy who got this job, which he may well have just based on, you know, political patronage. But, you know, he just absolutely did an outstanding job under the circumstances.
Anything you want to add to that period?
I think that the whole period was just an amazing episode. A revolution led by a journalist who decided to undo everything. And I contrasted it in my own mind with McCullough's quote where he said, "The arts were indispensable to the enjoyment and meaning of life in Paris," and how clearly that was not a universal sentiment, because there was a group that motivated a huge portion of the population to simply erase the arts. Mm-hmm. It's close to the Cultural Revolution in China, where it was just out with the old, anything that's old, destroy it. And it's such an overreaction that you think of the destruction of the Bamiyan Buddhist statues in Afghanistan. You know, can we just simply erase centuries of accumulation? Yeah, you can. And how fragile civilization is kind of sobering.
One of the, I guess, good things that came out of it when Louis Napoleon became the self-appointed dictator, that he arranges to have all that work done. And again, I mean, that wasn't 100% accepted. There was people that saw, you know, some of the destruction of some of the old things, but that there was certainly a lot of improvements made to Paris.
Well, yeah. When you're a dictator, you can do...
Yeah, you can do that.
you can do a lot of things.
We're not bond issues on the ballot.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to find, you know, any kind of political leader, whether Louis Napoleon or his uncle, you know, that's all negative. I mean, there were positive things that came from that. But, you know, McCullough also mentions, you know, even in regards to the new construction, you know, the corruption that surrounded it. And while Louis Napoleon himself probably didn't profit from it, he certainly had friends. They mentioned the American dentist, who was a very good friend, who profited mightily, you know, by buying up properties with the inside knowledge. And this would become known. I mean, people would see what's going on. And you know, this is going to cause, even though you may admire the boulevard, you know, there's still going to be resentment over, you know, exactly how it was done. Yeah.
So we mentioned that during these periods of revolution and violence, Americans, many of them would flee. Some would stay. Some were required to stay, like Washburn. But after this kind of tumultuous period, the Americans come back to Paris. They're still seeking the same thing. And in this period of time, McCullough is really talking about a variety of those artists. And he's mentioning Henry James, Mary Cassatt, and John Singer Sargent. And he kind of goes into pretty much detail about their lives. So, well, you know, what struck you about any of those three?
Well, it's both Henry and William James. The brothers were both there. And, again, they became a core feature of American intellectual history at Harvard, in particular, novelists and philosophers, and the idea that to top off a first-class, top-rate education involved a trip to Paris was still very much a part of the story. I think what happens in the next century is there become other choices, and people start thinking about Berlin and London and other capitals as equally important for people's opportunities. But what was, I think, part of the draw was this was the heyday of international expositions, where they would create these fantastic, elaborate shows of displaying a country, especially a top-tier country's technological and imperial successes around the world. And so the great Paris expositions, where they built the Eiffel Tower and had all the great artists compete with each other, and the Americans start to win a few prizes and show that, you know, we're no longer just this remote place of no particular accomplishment. We're starting to step on the stage as an industrial power, because this is the time period, especially after the Civil War, where the United States' wealth became disproportionately oversized compared to the rest of the world. We were able to have a few people in the Gilded Age that had such incredible spending power. They could literally go to Europe and buy just about anything, whole buildings, not just artwork, and walk. And that's, of course, why our country is loaded with museums of original European art that would never be allowed to leave the country in this day and age because of limitations. But we are not only becoming a source of accomplishment, but we were being inspired by these things that were happening in these great cities, London and Paris both. And Henry Adams was another one that's thrown in at the end there that, you know, he wrote that landmark book, The Education of Henry Adams, autobiographical, which really focuses near the end on the idea of technology and the dynamo of the great engines being the new focal point of social worship, replaced the Virgin of the Catholic Church, and, you know, the Virgin and the Dynamo is his famous chapter in that book, and that's coming from that one of the Paris expositions. So people are going there from America, taking inspiration, and coming back with all sorts of ideas that become American in their own right.
The three that I mentioned, James, Cassatt, Sargent, and then even later on, I think Wharton is mentioned, another author, and they all actually had come or been exposed to Europe as children. Their parents had brought them there. And so kind of, you know, what you'd been saying, that, you know, coming back as adults with, and all of them with the intention was to work, work, work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, James was very intent that that was what he was going to do while he was there, is he was going to be writing books. And then it's pointed out that Mary Cassatt and John Singer Sargent came from families of the leisure class, where these people, they did nothing. They sat around, he says, and you know, read books.
And we had some contrarians mixed in there. Mark Twain was part of the mix that went over there. And he wrote, of course, the fantastic Innocents Abroad, which is kind of his equivalent of Moose the movie in the Valley. It's us making fun of ourselves. So he's making fun of Americans, you know, the collecting the pieces off statues, chipping them off, taking them home as souvenirs. You know, I don't know that anyone looking at Moose the movie from the outside would think it was meant to be a joke. I think we see it that way. But The same thing with Mark Twain. You know, he's seeing the people you describe as the ones, the leisure class, that he didn't like. He didn't like the Gilded Age, but he's kind of making fun of them at the same time. It's one of our, I think, our national traits, is we do have the ability to quite often make fun of ourselves in a way that we know how to laugh at ourselves, which I think is a healthy feature.
Mm-hmm.
So many of these people, a couple of others that you mentioned, Henry Adams, but then also the sculptor, Augustus St. Gaudens, you know, by going, a lot of them exposed to Europe as children, then come back as adults to work, 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 and, you know, learn their art, whether it was writing or sculpture or painting. Do you think that, had they not gone to Europe, had they stayed in the United States, that they would have been as creative or as productive?
Probably not. You know, talent is talent, you know, and there was a certain amount of talent there, but it's just one of those things where you expose, the more exposure you have to, you know, sitting or walking around the Louvre, or, being exposed to other artists, not just the other, you know, French or European artists, but, you know, Americans that came, and in the case of Cassatt, you know, there were other Americans that came, because she did spend most of her life in that, but Americans would gravitate, especially American women would gravitate, artists would gravitate to her, So she was like another source of knowledge, you know. And so, yeah, it's hard to imagine that you would have had Mary Cassatt would have been as productive if she had, you know, stayed in the United States.
Certainly would have never seen the other Impressionists.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. I mean, she may have seen the art, you know, if it on display here, I guess, you know, but yeah, that's right. She would never have had that exposure.
You know, they said that St. Gaudens supposedly was under the tutelage of an artist named Jerome, who was supposed to be one of the premier people, and that he had a list of things that he got out of that, you know, conceiving of an idea, sticking to it, and not doing it in haste. And you could certainly argue, well, he could have basically done those things without that exposure. But part of it, again, is connections. You know, one of his patrons in life later on was Henry Adams. When Henry Adams' wife committed suicide, he went to St. Gaudens to do one of St. Gaudens' most famous statues, which is this veiled, shady figure sitting in life-size on the tomb site with much. It's a very, very powerful image, and you'd have to almost say, well, that almost looks European in part of its imagery. So, you know, there's the influence, but also the connections that come from just meeting the people he did by being over there that were from the class in the United States that would be connecting him to all sorts of opportunities that he might not have otherwise had. I agree, you know, he obviously was a raw talent, but he probably got the boost that made him the very top level that maybe would not have occurred had he not been there.
In that sense of concentrated talent, that these people, even though they all came from America and later, you know, they kind of congregate together in Paris, but that the experience is also that they're meeting Parisian artists and people who have something to offer. So it's that concentration of talent so that they can get exposure to all of that. Do you think that McCullough romanticizes any of this time period at all? I mean, I think
sure.
We look back and we always think, oh, how lovely, I would have loved to have done that. But
it's realistic. I mean, I think especially in the first part of the book, death is very much an omnipresent feature, which would have been in that period of world history to almost any society. But why not romanticize it? It was romantic. I mean, there's nothing wrong with romanticizing something. And certainly the people reflected over and over again, they were romanticized themselves by the whole event and would live with that forever as the, in many cases, the pinnacle of their existence, the happy moments.
But he does not ignore, you know, the political problems, the revolution, bloodshed, disease, you know, just, and that these people, you mentioned the suicide and, you know, what these people had problems. I mean, they were not perfect lives. You know, I had the stresses and that could just come with being alive. So I don't think he really, you know, overly romanticized anything. I felt it was pretty straightforward.
So do you think that there's other bonds that tied the United States and France together? You know, why did they pick Paris? I mean, we've been talking about that as the center of the old world, but there's a lot of places that were really centers of the old world.
I haven't covered that, you know, a little bit in the beginning is because, you know, if you were looking at Europe from America at that time, I guess the two cities you would have seen would have been London and Paris, and we had more of an alliance. We'd had certainly more friction with Britain, even though that was our language, that was our heritage. I think we came back that direction later, particularly after the, you know, during the First World War. But there were just numerous times, you know, we know about a revolution and the War of 1812, but there were other times that the United States and Britain were, you know, came very close to war. So I think that was always a kind of more repellent type of thing, maybe not an attraction to Paris. Sometimes it was more rejection of London, you know. I might be one way to look at it.
Well, I think it started to lose steam as the center of everything. By the late 1800s, Americans were going to other places. But that initial period from the 1830s to the 1880s was probably the high point, although there's kind of a revival in it in the early 1900s with the American writer class, the people like Hemingway and gathering in Paris and
Yeah, in the 19 after the First World War.
Yeah,
yeah, there was actually. Yeah.
And I had made a note of that you know, he ends the book at about the turn of the century or at the end of the 1800s, and I had just started reading a book by Edith Wharton, and also I had visited Europe as a child and went on to become a great American writer, and then went to France to live and write and became involved in the First World War. And doing humanitarian acts. And so she takes a break in 1916 to write this book that I'm currently reading, Summer. But so there was, he could have continued with other Americans who seek out Paris as a cultural site and a place where they could ply their trade and learn their work.
So where do Americans go now?
Palmer.
Maybe Puerto Rico? I don't know. Where is it cheaper to live, huh?
Well, of course, people come here, too. Mm-hmm. Now, I suppose kind of a full circle thing. I think, a lot of people do, particularly from Asia, but even Europe, people come here, for opportunities and whatnot.
Where people go now for the equivalent experience would be American universities on the East Coast. They are the new center of international. We are the new Paris for the time being. If you want a first-class college education, we're the top 10 universities in the world. Almost any measure would put you on the northeastern United States for the time being.
But just to step back in history one more minute, because I was trying to imagine what those international expositions looked like, and I was thinking of them as an early day Disneyland, and so you had mentioned, Disneyland before. So, just to conceptualize, hundreds of thousands of people attended these things.
Millions of people attended them, and in many ways they are much criticized today because if you get to the more outrageous examples, in the Chicago 1893 exposition, they were literally moving entire villages of people from Africa to put on display for people to look at as to see how people lived in primitive countries, It would today be considered scandalous, but it was a reflection not only of technological achievement, but of also the thought of the day, which was the white man's burden, or that the Western civilization was meant to rule and civilize the rest of the world, and we can achieve these things and we can help these lesser peoples would be the premise that was operating behind much of that. That these are expositions of what civilization looks like and includes vignettes. In 1909 in Seattle, they actually made plywood icebergs and brought actual Eskimos to sit on them in parkas to show people what Eskimos look like on ice floes. It's in many ways, it was hugely entertaining, but at the same time would not be tolerated.
But it did spark a lot of competition. And I know in Devil in the White City, they talk about how they were trying to best the Eiffel Tower. And so, we get the Ferris wheel.
They were hugely expensive because of that.
Well, they had that comment there in the book on the two Chicagoans at the Paris Exposition. Mm-hmm. He says, well, it's not as good as Chicago's. He says, well, yeah, I knew that before I left Chicago.
Exactly, It tells again, there's the American point of view.
Right.
So I want to thank Tallis and Kevin for joining me today as we talked about The Greater Journey, Americans of Paris by David McCullough. Thank you both.
Thank you. Well,
thanks for having me.
Next month, we'll be reading and discussing On Immunity by Eula Biss. The publisher states, in this bold, fascinating book, Biss investigates the metaphors and myths surrounding our conception of immunity and its implications for the individual and the social body. As she hears more and more fears about vaccines, Biss researches what they mean for her own child, her immediate community, America, and the world, historically and in the present moment. Kind of going back to something Kevin said earlier, even about thinking in terms of history and our medical advances. Joining me will be Deb Guidosh and Renee Dillo from Public Health. I also want to remind listeners that 89.5 is a community radio station that relies on support from listeners like you, so please take the time to visit our website, radiofreepalmer.org, and become a contributing member. This is Judy Getty with Radio Book Club. Happy reading.
Thank you, Tim.